Last week, the former chief financial officer of Enron, Andrew Fastow, stood before a judge and admitted that he and other members of Enron's senior management fraudulently manipulated Enron's publicly reported financial results. I am quoting here from a statement that he gave to prosecutors in this case. The statement also reads, I, that is Mr. Fastow, also engaged in schemes to enrich myself and others at the expense of Enron's shareholders and in violation of my duty of honest services to those shareholders. He agreed to serve 10 years in prison and to give up something like $30 million in cash. And I think that it is widely expected that he will also be assisting in the prosecution of other management at Enron, particularly the two guys at the top, Jeff Skilling and Ken Lay. Just today, as you heard in the NPR news, another top executive, the company's former top accountant, surrendered early Thursday. The AP report reads he was taken in handcuffs to the courthouse to face federal charges related to the collapse of Enron in 2001. In light of these recent events, we thought it would be a good time to check in again on this story and talk with a guest that was on this program just about a year ago. His name is Robert Bryce. He's a Texas-based business journalist and has been writing about and following Enron for a long time, certainly before quite a few years before the collapse. He's authored a book on this, which is titled Pipe Dreams, Greed, Ego, and the Death of Enron. And that book is now just out in paperback. So if you're interested in reading the story, you can head out to the bookstore and look at it. And of course, questions here are welcome. 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. And the questions are certainly welcome. Mr. Bryce, hello.
Hi, good morning, David.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us again.
Of course.
We certainly appreciate it. I'm sure at some point here I want to talk about Mr. Causey. This was one fellow that, as I listened back to the conversation we had last January, his name did not come up. We didn't talk about him, so I want to make sure that we do.
Sure.
But I guess the place it probably is to start with Andrew Fastow, because his plea is so significant, and also the fact that he has a lot of information about what happened at Enron, and no doubt will provide that to prosecutors who are going after others. In fact, there was a quote here in one of the stories. This was quoting the guy who was basically running the effort to go after former Enron employees. He said, for the first time, the Enron task force has a seat on the 50th floor of Enron. He says anyone who was committing crimes at Enron with Andy Fastow should be concerned.
Right.
So, how concerned should they be?
Well, I think at this point, probably very concerned. I mean, you know, if Jeff Skilling has so far proven to be very elusive to the prosecutors, and it's allegedly because in talking with some people who worked at Enron who are privy to some of the details, the prosecutors can't find Skilling's signature on any of the key documents. So it's going to take the testimony of people like Causey or Fastow or others who were, you know, in direct contact with him to give the prosecutors the kind of ammunition they need to indict Skilling, which is clearly what they've been wanting to do ever since Skilling testified before Congress and put on that performance that was so, I think, just arrogant beyond measure.
Mm. Well, let's talk about Andrew Fastow. What is it that he was accused of doing at Enron?
Well, he was indicted on over 100 federal counts, wire fraud, conspiracy, mail fraud, securities fraud. He was facing a whole bunch of different lines of attack from the prosecutors. He was very eager to make a deal because he faced up over 100 years in prison. The prosecutors were eager to make a deal because, I think, honestly, they didn't want to go to trial because they were afraid of a long, drawn-out trial. They almost lost the Anderson trial. They did get a conviction against Arthur Anderson. But that, you know, in looking back at it, that was only because of a very narrow interpretation by the trial judge. So I think the prosecutors realized that if they had gone to trial, they stood a possibility of losing and not convicting Fastow, which would have been disaster for them. So getting the plea bargain with Andy Fastow and Lee Fastow, you know, was something the prosecutors wanted very badly. However, and I've written an op-ed that I expect will be published in the next few days. I think that the you know, the plea bargain that the Fastows got is terrible for the criminal justice system. Maybe good for the Enron task force, but overall, I think it's not nearly harsh enough. And I think it it just simply proves once again that, you know, it, in terms of white collar crime, crime pays.
Mm. Well, it seems that the central thing here, at least the thing that, that everybody fixes on when you talk about, well, what is it that Andy Fastow was accused of doing? It's he is always described as the chief architect of the off-books accounting practices,
right,
that the company used to inflate its, to conceal its conceal its financial condition, to its inflate its profits,
yeah,
and to get money losing divisions of the company. Essentially, they didn't really get rid of them, but they sort of shoved them over in a dark corner,
exactly,
so that people didn't really, the true financial condition of the company was not known, and it was deliberately distorted.
Well, and that, and that's exactly right, and that's a good summation. I guess the way I think about it is, and as I described it in Pipe Dreams, that Fastow and his wife set up two companies, LJM1 and LJM2. They were, the companies were essentially big parking lots for Enron. In over a course of 2 or 2.5 years, Enron did about 24 deals with Fastow's companies, LJM1 and LJM2. In every one of those deals, the Fastows made money. And here's how it worked. Enron had, say, a power plant in Europe that was not as successful. It was in fact, it may have been losing money. So Enron agreed to sell that to LJM, and Enron further said to LJM, "We will guarantee that you won't lose any money on this deal, and we'll buy it back from you if you can't find another buyer." So Enron moved that asset off of its balance sheet and counted the money that it got from LJM for the asset as a sale. And then they could use that money toward their profits, right, and show that they were indeed making money. Well, LJM then had investors that they were getting from Merrill Lynch and from a lot of high-powered money managers, because they said, well, we can go and get in business with the CFO at Enron, and he knows Enron's business better than anybody. So, of course, they wanted to get into business with him. All of these deals that the Fastows made with Enron were fantastically profitable. In between 1998 and 2000, the Fastows' personal income, according to their own admittedly false income tax returns, was on the order of $60 million.
So that's an important point. To not only did what they did make the company look good on paper, but they personally benefited to the tune of tens of millions of dollars.
Exactly. And that $60 million that they made over those 3 years, that's separate and apart from the salary that they were being paid. Lee Fastow, Andy Fastow's wife, who's also going to be going to prison, but only for 5 months, she also pled guilty to one count, I think it was a tax evasion. She was facing 6 felony charges. But that money, that $60 million that they made, is exclusive of stock options that they had and salary. So there were, you know, several millions. I think Fastow's total stock option sales were something on the order of $30 million. So, you know, the thing that I'm glad to see some of these Enron guys being carried off in handcuffs. However, you know, when you look more broadly at what is happening in terms of criminal justice in America, and you think, okay, a street-level crack dealer there in Urbana or wherever, if he's caught with 5 grams of crack cocaine, he does a mandatory minimum of 5 years. So, how is the justice system in America so skewed that here you have a couple who have stolen tens of millions of dollars, and she goes to prison for 5 months, he goes to prison for 10 years, and when they get out, they're still rich beyond measure? So I don't know. I'm happy that some of these people are being prosecuted, but I'm sorely disappointed at the way the system is working.
Yeah, let me just reintroduce real quick our guest, Robert Bryce. He's a business journalist. He's based in Texas. He's written for a number of publications, including the New York Times, The Guardian, Austin Chronicle, Texas Observer. He has been writing about Enron's activities since 1997, back before the company collapsed. He also covered the firm's telecommunications and e-commerce ventures throughout 2001. He's authored a book about the collapse of Enron. The title of his book is Pipe Dreams, Greed, Ego, and the Death of Enron. The book is now out in paperback if you'd like to read it. And we thought it'd be, he was here on the program about a year ago, a little bit more, and we thought since there have been some recent developments in this story, we would ask him if he would talk with us again. He said yes, he would. So questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. In one of the stories about the Fastow plea, there was a quote here from an attorney who is representing the whistleblower, Sharon Watkins, Philip Hilder. And he says, of Fastow, he says, he seemingly had everything. He had looks, brains, power, an interesting job, a great future, a wife from a prominent family. He's thrown it all away. The quest for money was the controlling factor. I imagine you have some sense of who Andy Fastow is. What do you think led him to do what he did?
Well, my dime store psychoanalysis of Andy Fastow is fairly simple. His father was a plumbing fixture salesman. They were from New Jersey. You know, they were a middle-class family. They weren't starving by any means. But Andy Fastow married a woman named Lee Weingarten. The Weingartens in Houston are, their family is among the most prominent families in the entire city. They are extraordinarily wealthy. They had a chain of grocery stores, then they went into the real estate business. So he married into this extraordinarily wealthy family, and I think, you know, a lot of his motivation was that he wanted to show that he belonged. He wanted to show that he could make the big money, that he could live in River Oaks, which was the very exclusive neighborhood in Houston. He wanted to prove that to the Weingarten family, but he also wanted to prove it to Jeff Skilling, who was the, you know, the CEO at Enron and a very stern taskmaster and a very egotistical guy who believed very much that he and his the people around him were the smartest and the best looking and so on. So I think it was both of those things. But if were I to point to one thing more than another, I think it would be him wanting to prove himself to the Weingartens that he was a big player.
Yeah, and I think here the connection with Skilling probably is important. At least when we talked before, you said that maybe one of the things that was behind the move into these illegal accounting practices was Skilling's desire for growth in the company. He apparently felt that Enron was not growing fast enough. So even though, as you say, the difficulty for the investigators so far has been that they can't find Skilling's signature on anything. There's no paper trail linking him to what happened. But you seem to be suggesting that in fact, there was really no way that he could not have known, and that perhaps Fastow wouldn't be where he was or wouldn't have been doing what he was doing had it not been for Jeff Skilling.
Absolutely. I think I even have that quote in Pipe Dreams that, you know, one of the people who worked with both of those guys said that Fastow wouldn't go to the bathroom without asking Skilling for permission first. That Skilling knew that, you know, Wall Street, particularly at the time he was CEO, 97, 98, 99, that in that period that you had to show consistent earnings growth. And none of the analysts were looking closely to see how that growth happened. But you had to make your numbers. And they were struggling. And Enron was not growing in the way that was going to please Wall Street, and Skilling knew he had to, you know, cut some corners, and Fastow was willing to do whatever it took to make the number that, which was generally, very consistently rather, one penny over the consistent analyst estimate of Enron's earnings per share. Hmm. And Fastow was masterful at managing those numbers to make that one penny over the estimate happen quarter after quarter.
Skilling, Jeff Skilling, at the time of the collapse of the company, was the chief operating officer, right?
He was president and COO, right?
COO. He was put into that position by Ken Lay, who, and as we talked before, you said that you thought perhaps Ken Lay made two really bad decisions during his time at Enron. One of them was to make Jeff Skilling the chief operating officer, and the other one was to get rid of the guy who had that job before.
Right.
A guy named Kinder.
Rich Kinder.
Kinder.
Yeah.
Rich Kinder. And so Skilling, and when Skilling came in, the character of the company changed. He really shaped not only the direction, but perhaps also the personality, reshaped the personality of Enron.
Absolutely.
So maybe that's something that you can talk about, how it is that he did that, and how, when he moved into that position, how it is that he changed the company, or the company itself, the personality of the company.
Sure.
Changed.
Well, I'll back up and ask or answer a question that you didn't ask, but that is related to this, and that is that Rich Kinder has been the one executive kind of in all of this scandal who's really escaped much notice. And unless you're closely reading the business press, you wouldn't know who Kinder is. Mm. Kinder left Enron in late 96 and started a new company called Kinder Morgan. Right now, Kinder Morgan, I don't know of any executive now in America who, in any industry, who has made more money in the last 6 or 7 years than Rich Kinder. He left Enron in 96 worth about $30 million. Today, he's the third richest man in Houston. His net worth is something like $1.3 billion. He's turned Kinder Morgan, which he bought a small pipeline from Enron in 97. Kinder Morgan is now carrying something like 15% of all the natural gas in America through their system of pipelines. Jeff Skilling hated pipelines. Kinder, when he was at Enron, was a very focused guy and really focused on pipelines. He left. Skilling hated the pipeline business. He tried to make Enron into anything but a gas pipeline business. Kinder loved the pipeline business and since then has built an empire on the gas pipeline business. And now Kinder Morgan, in fact, just yesterday announced that they were increasing their dividend. It's a master limited partnership, and I won't bore you with all the details of that. But they're increasing their dividend, I think, something like by 50%. I mean, the companies that Kinder now heads are making money hand over fist, and Enron Corporation is bankrupt. So that's an aside, but it is also kind of part of, I think, answers your question regarding the tenor of the company. Kinder was a very numbers-focused, cash-focused guy, very hard-nosed businessman who really wanted to see how, you know, to grow the business. Skilling was interested in flash and dash and trading and doing all these things that weren't about making his customers happy and increasing the revenues and increasing the profits. Instead, he wanted to have lots of glitz and glamour and not really do the hard work.
We have a caller here to talk with
sure.
in over by Danville in Belgium. We'll do that, and I also want to invite other people. You know, if you have questions, you can give us a call. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Here's the caller on our toll-free line. Line 4, hello.
Hello.
Yeah.
Just before this Enron thing broke in, about 2000, 2001, in California, the rate of electricity and gas and everything went to the roof, and it seemed to be tied somewhat to similar sort of things as this. Now, this year, our natural gas prices are going right straight through the sky again, and here you're talking about some gentleman who is making obscene profits. I wonder if there's some connection here.
I don't think so. Kinder Morgan doesn't buy any gas. They're simply transporters. They are only paid for the use of their pipelines. From everything that I can tell and everything that I've seen in the natural gas business over the past few years, what's happening is simply that the supply is not keeping up with demand. We've had a cold winter so far, particularly in the Northeast, and this latest Arctic storm. And in the last few years, there have been a whole bunch of electric power plants that have been built that are gas-fired. America's gas reserves are declining simply because, you know, that's what they do. After you drill them and you pump them for a while, they start to run out. And so we're simply not being able to keep up with supply, and that means that the price rises. And, of course, this has been predicted for years and years, and finally I think it's starting to prove out that the gas supply in North America is starting to decline, and pretty soon we're going to have to be importing natural gas from other countries, which is also going to be expensive.
I had heard that the particular agency the utility around here that we use is Illinois Power.
Right.
And Illinois Power for years would pump their natural gas into holding reservoirs, wherever they may be, and then buy the gas cheap and then sell it more reasonable in the winter when we needed it. But now they use these peakers, and they use natural gas, just as you said. So instead of storing the natural gas during the summer and getting us a good rate, they consume it to generate electricity and charging us the higher rates at the time when it's needed. That sounds like it's almost some type of collusion too, isn't it?
Well, as far as I know, any gas utility, whether it's delivering gas for your stovetop or for delivering gas to industrial use or to electric power plant, if they have any access to underground storage, they use it because that acts as their buffer. They use it as a piggy bank, for lack of a better word, to kind of smooth out peaks and troughs in the natural gas pricing, so that they're continually buying gas on the open market and storing it in case there's a cold snap or whatever, that's the way that they try and smooth out the pricing. So, I can't speak to whether, what the practices are there locally, but, virtually every big gas user, if they can, uses some kind of an underground cavern, underground storage to store gas, and hopefully buy it cheaper in the summer and store it for the winter, and hopefully save themselves some money. So, I don't know of any collusion. I can't speak to that.
Okay, thank you very much, sir.
All right,
sure.
Let's go to someone in Indiana on our line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Just an offside. I live close to an area which farmers make money from the gas companies by letting people use their land underneath, the corn. But my question deals with one of the first things you said at the beginning. You thought that 10 years in terms of the plea bargain just wasn't enough. I was wondering if you could say what you thought the sentence should be and speak around those issues if you could. I've been keeping up with this, and no one's ever talked about that side of the story at all. I just wanted to get your ideas on it. Thanks.
Sure, happy to. Years ago, the federal courts and the legislature thought, well, what's the way to deal with the drug problem? Well, we need mandatory minimums. We got to, make sure that these drug offenders know that if they get caught, they're going to serve time and that there's not going to be any way that they can avoid doing major time. Well, now we have a rash of white-collar crime. And I mean, serious problems. All these people going to, on trial now, Dennis Kozlowski and Martha Stewart and Sam Wachsel and so on and so forth. So, if we have mandatory minimums for the guys who are just selling, crack and speed on the street, why can't we have some mandatory minimums for some of these white-collar shysters? I mean, in the case of, Fastow, why not have a mandatory minimum that says something like, for each $10 billion in stock market value that you lose for your company, you go to prison for 5 years. Well, under that kind of a metric, Fastow would be going to the joint for 35 years, not 10 years, because Enron was worth $70 billion and now it's worth zip. So, what I fundamentally object to in the case of the Fastows and in the case of some of these other white-collar crooks is that they steal tens of millions of dollars. Then they go out and they hire the best criminal defense lawyers in the world. Fastow's lawyers are Mike DeGuerin and John Kecker. Well, you cannot find two better criminal defense lawyers on earth than those two guys. So they steal the money. They use the money to pay the best lawyers who help them then get a light sentence. Well, that's fundamentally, I think, wrong. And, I think that they should be doing more, particularly in the case of Lee Fastow, more than 5 months. Why? Well, again, using the drug dealer comparison, if she was caught with crack, she'd go to prison for 5 years. Instead, she files false income tax returns and is actually stealing money from me. I mean, I pay my taxes. So, the corner drug dealer in Chicago doesn't really bother me, but if she's cheating on her taxes, she's cheating me too. So, I just think that there's a fundamental fairness question here that is not being addressed.
Hmm. Well, it seems pretty clear that the deal that they worked with her and also with the couple so that they would not both be in jail at the same time, so someone would be at home with the kids, was intended to put pressure or give incentive to Andy Fastow for him to be cooperative.
Absolutely. And that was, and that makes sense, of course, and they really wanted to get the Fastows. They really wanted to get him in prison, and they achieved that. And, I'm all for keeping families together, but how often do prosecutors actually do that poor and indigent offenders? Do they worry about who's going to take care of the kids? Or is this just something that, because the fast house have a lot of dough, that they get to bargain on that kind of a thing?
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Robert Bryce. He has been following Enron for a long time, many years before the collapse of the company. He's authored a book on the subject. It's titled Pipe Dreams, Greed, Ego, and the Death of Enron. It was first published, last year, and is by Public Affairs. And I think that the hardcover, I think, is still out there, but it is now available in a paperback if you'd like to read the book. Who's the publisher on the paperback?
It's Public Affairs again.
It's the same publisher. Okay.
Yeah, and in fact, Public Affairs is going to be publishing my next book, which will be out in June, which the title is Cronies, Oil, the Bushes, and the Rise of Texas, America's Superstate.
Oh, I guess we'll have to talk again.
Well, I hope so.
All right. We will go on to some other callers, and next is someone in Danville, line two. Hello.
Yes, hello. It's been established that there has been close contact with the government in Texas and his administration. Since that time, they've moved up to the presidency and administration of our country. I wonder if there's been anything done to tie any of the contacts to the Bush-Cheney administration, and if anything's been done about Cheney not announcing the ties he had and the meetings with the Enron officials when they first took over.
Sure. Well, up through 2000, it was clear and has been well established that Enron was George W. Bush's biggest career patron. They gave Enron executives and Enron itself gave Bush and his campaigns for governor and then for president something on the order of $700,000. The Enron company, Enron Corp, had access to George W. Bush and his people throughout his tenure as governor, and then when he got to the White House. When Dick Cheney was heading this energy policy task force, and they released their report in May of 2001, they had something like a dozen different contacts with Enron officials. In one case, Ken Lay had a face-to-face meeting with Dick Cheney, gave him a list of talking points about the California energy crisis, which was raging at that time. Electric prices in California were going crazy. And Lay, his talking point with Cheney was something to the effect of, you know, we need to let the free market act here. You know, California doesn't have enough electric generating capacity, and we don't want any price caps put into place. The very next day, Dick Cheney gave an interview to the Los Angeles Times in which he repeated nearly word for word the talking points that Ken Lay had given him the day before. Price caps are a bad idea. You know, we need to let the free market work here. Meanwhile, electric prices in California are approaching $1,500 a megawatt hour. So, but let's jump to the end story in California. Well, the power prices are killing the economy. They're looking at and renewed threats of blackouts because companies like Enron are gaming the system. They're withholding power. They're charging excessively. Finally, in June of 2001, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission places soft price caps on the price of power in California. And what happened? The price of power in California collapsed. The markets became rational again. Prices went from hundreds of dollars per megawatt hour to tens of dollars per hour. And the market, sanity was restored to the market. Why? Because finally the federal government imposed itself in an irrational market, something that Enron didn't want to see happen. You know, I think it's a scandal, to answer the question more directly, the connections between Enron and the Bush administration are absolutely the most concrete proof that political money is corrupting the process, and Bush's administration has been Enron's, favored entity throughout Enron's the last few years of its life, and I think it's a scandal.
Well, I sure agree with you that justice certainly is blind. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks for the call. We will continue and next talk with a caller here in locally in Champaign County, line number one.
Yeah, further on that point, Do you know anything about what the investigative reporter Greg Pallister said about the? It came out just before the election in California that apparently Cruz Bustamante, the still Senate governor, had some kind of suit to recoup the losses from the gaming power manipulators like Enron and Southern Company, and I think one other was named. And there was an allegation that it was going to be dropped after Schwarzenegger was elected, and I don't know if it's progressed anywhere. And in relation to that, that's sort of like gaming the what you were just talking about and manipulating FERC and stuff. But I think when you were on last time, I might have asked you about the international dimension, because this is even clearer. Well, it may not be clear, but it's an additional kind of explicit quid pro quo and favors done by the Bush administration. I think the most obvious ones are the one in Argentina, where someone from the Bush administration called and sort of said Enron gave them a gracious letter of introduction, et cetera. You know, I'm being facetious there. It's actually and then in India too, there was, this was all while the IMF was like encouraging and at gunpoint, sort of at the financial extremist point, privatization, and we were I think you can take those two points and run with them. Actually, I'm glad to hear you on again, and I'm looking forward to your next book too. Actually,
well, thanks. Let me just discuss the thing in California that sticks in my craw regarding those contracts. The litigation over the contracts regarding the electricity that California was forced to buy from companies like Enron and the other pirates in Houston, they have gone. They appealed in civil court. They appealed also to the FERC to say, "Look, this was price gouging. We should not have to pay the entire price of these contracts, whether they were long term electric contracts or whatever, because there was price gouging. There was collusion. These were fraudulent contracts." Well, they took this argument to the FERC, and the FERC said, "No. In fact, these contracts are valid. You have to pay the price of these contracts." And I'll digress for a moment and say, one of the reasons the FERC had to do that was because Wendy Graham, who later ended up on Enron's board right after she left the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, had pushed through a regulation that said that the FERC and the CFTC would have no regulation over these kinds of electric futures contracts, even if they were designed to be fraudulent. Okay, so there was a loophole in the law that Enron could foist these fraudulent contracts on their counterparties, and there could be no federal intervention to revoke them. Okay, so again, FERC has said, no, these contracts are valid, California, you have to pay Enron and the other electric suppliers, even though you got ripped off. Okay, so how does that square with the fact that now the Department of Justice and the Enron Task Force are indicting the traders who put these fraudulent contracts into place? So, I mean, where's the consistency in federal law here? On one hand, what the traders did is wrong and illegal, and they may go to jail, but the contracts they put into place are valid, and California has to pay. So that's, you know, again, this is one of the things about justice, and the lack of justice is occurring in the wake of this Enron meltdown that I think is just unconscionable. As far as what's happening overseas, you know, Enron lost tens of millions of dollars, tens of billions overseas, by arm twisting in India, by, you know, the Bush administration did virtually everything that Enron wanted, even getting the National Security Council involved to pressure India to pay for electricity that they had gotten from a power plant that Enron had built in India called Dabol. So, you know, between, you know, the contracts in California and the Bush administration acting as Enron's errand boy for some of these overseas projects, you know, again, I think it's a scandal.
Wendy Graham is the wife, lobbyist wife of the former Texas senator from Enron, Phil Graham, is that right?
That's Wendy Graham, yes.
Do you know anything about the specific lawsuit in California and this law that she had passed? I guess it might undercut the... But as you say, it's amazingly ironic that they can be putting these people away, or if they indeed do, but then not admit that the whole thing was rigged and that there should be some redress.
Oh, the irony just or the coincidence just doesn't stop. In fact, Phil Graham is now working for UBS, the Swiss banking company that took over Enron's trading business after Enron went bankrupt. So, you know, it's all one big happy family down here in Texas.
In Switzerland, too, apparently. But, yeah, I thought he would probably stay away from that. But I guess maybe I was thinking that's why he didn't run again. But I guess maybe he just got a better offer out of the public eye or something.
Yeah, as they used to say in Washington, the most dangerous place to stand in Washington is between Phil Gramm and a camera. But maybe it's between Phil Gramm and the paycheck. I don't know which.
Thanks a lot.
All right.
Sure.
We have about 20 minutes left in this first hour of Focus 580. Our guest is Robert Bryce. He's a business journalist. He's based in Texas. He's written for a number of publications, including the Austin Chronicle and the Texas Observer. And he's been writing about Enron for a number of years, back since 1997. He's authored a book on the collapse of Enron, which is titled Pipe Dreams, Greed, Ego, and the Death of Enron. It's been out about a year, and just recently now has been published in a paperback edition. If you'd like to read it, Public Affairs is the publisher of the book. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Way back at the beginning, I mentioned the fact that in addition to the plea bargain by Andrew Fastow, just today now there has been another development, as apparently the man who was the chief accounting officer, Richard Causey, has surrendered, has been taken into custody. And apparently he is also another one of those former executives of the company that the government has been after for some time now. Let's talk about him and what I'm not sure that in the story that I've read and have just seen this one that's been running on the Associated Press this morning, I don't think it says anything about what he's likely to be charged with.
Right. Well, I've just been trying to catch up with that myself. I think that he was indicted on six charges. Let me see. Oh, that he was involved in concealing some of the losses at Enron Broadband, which was Enron's telecommunications business. Enron Broadband was arguably the single biggest fraud at Enron. This was where Enron said that they were going to get into the telephone and telecom business in the same way that they had been in the gas and electric power business, and they were going to apply these same models. The problem was, of course, that the telecom business is nowhere comparable to electric and gas delivery, and I won't bore you with all the details of that. But nevertheless, that is apparently the main focus of why Causey is now being indicted, is his involvement with those deals, and also with his involvement in some of the off-balance sheet financing deals. Causey, I mean, for 18 months, people in Houston have been saying, wondering when Causey was going to be indicted, and now that he's been indicted, I think it finally is giving a lot of people that I know who worked at Enron are finally, saying, well, finally, they finally got him charged with something.
Mm. We also want to make sure that we talk a little bit about Ken Lay, who was the chairman of Enron. And just apparently right after Andrew Fastow's plea bargain, Ken Lay's attorney, his name is Mike Ramsey, held a press conference and said that that soon Mr. Lay would publicly address what happened with the company, and he said something like he's getting restless and wants to discuss the matter. He said, he was quoted in the story as saying that Ramsey says Lay and the board had no way to know the company was being looted, and also mentioned the fact that Lay himself was injured in this, losing hundreds of millions of dollars. And I think when we talked before, one of the things you said about Ken Lay was that while he might well have had an academic background in economics, that he really didn't understand the way the company worked, and so his role was to be the public face of the company. He was the guy who went out and made appearances and shook hands. And so I guess the question is, just how much did Ken Lay know about what Skilling and Fastow and Causey and a lot of other people were doing?
Well, that's the $64 question. Lay had a PhD in economics from the University of Houston. Nobody's ever said he's a dumb guy, but I think that the prosecutors are now trying to establish what it was that Lay knew and when did he know it. I think that for him to say, there was no way for the board to know this, that's hogwash. In fact, Ken Lay was the man who hired Skilling. He was the man who approved the hiring of Fastow. Lay was the one who originally went to the board with a bunch of these off-balance sheet partnerships and asked the board to approve them. Lay was the one who, you know, had he been paying attention to Enron's financial statements, would have seen that that Enron was not really making any money, that in fact there was no cash coming in the door, that Enron was going deeper and deeper into debt. The punchline for me is that the failure of Enron is Ken Lay's fault. The failure of Enron is Ken Lay's fault. He was the captain of the ship. The command reflects the commander. This guy cannot simply say, I didn't know, it's not my fault. He lost a lot of money. There's no question about that. And I think that's what's happened and what's come out in the press in the last few months shows that, you know, he kept buying Enron stock even as it was falling, thinking that it was going to all turn around. I feel badly about that, but the fact is the guy still lives in an $11 million penthouse in one of the most exclusive buildings in Houston. He and his wife still own a lot of property in Houston. He's still a rich man. So, you know, I don't have any sympathy for Ken Lay. And, you know, regardless of what he says and what he'll, you know, what he'll, how restless he's getting to tell his side of the story, the fact is that he bears culpability here. Whether it's criminal culpability, I don't know whether the feds are going to be able to get him or not.
Hmm. Let's talk with someone else. In Urbana, line one. Hello.
Yeah, I have two questions. One is, I really enjoy the way your take on all this, and I was just curious, first, whether or not you've got a business degree or maybe an accounting degree, or have you ever worked for business?
No, I'm just, I'm a lowly, I got a Bachelor in Fine Arts degree from the University of Texas. So, no, I don't have a business background. I guess I'm just curious, and I call my brother a lot. He's a CPA, so I don't understand anything. I call him.
There you go. And the other thing is, well, you've really got a good take on this, in my opinion. And I have earned a CPA before, so. And can you give us a general idea of the? Can you give an idea of what the general attitude of your colleagues and in particular the editors are in terms of this whole debacle and maybe in particular trying to point out the uneven justice meted out to corporate crooks? Can you give us some idea of what's going on? I know it's I get the feeling lots of times with journalists on this program that they don't like to kiss and tell, but maybe you could somehow get it in there between the lines.
Well, okay. I guess I've been out of the newspaper game for a while. I've just been writing books for the last 2 years, so you know I'm not the best one to even kiss and tell because I can't get anybody to kiss me. I think that particularly in situations like this, nobody wants to say that this isn't a harsh enough penalty. That, the expectation has been, and even the New York Times reporters have been saying, this is a big win for prosecutors and blah, blah, blah. And I look at it and I think, look, here's Fastow, who's going to walk away, even after he does 10 years in jail, with tens of millions of dollars. His shenanigans and those of his cronies cost 10,000 people at least their jobs, their pensions, and in many cases their careers. And he gets off with 10 years and he still gets to be rich. I'm sorry. That just ain't enough for me. I've seen what the devastation has been on these people's lives, and I just think, it's not enough. As far as the attitude of the editors and, the powers that be in journalism, I'm dealing with a great book publisher, and they're very happy with what I'm doing, and I'm just trying to, keep going and, keep writing books because I find that to be more rewarding.
Yeah, but it does definitely appear from our point of view, the ordinary Joe's point of view, that there's not even a large minority that you could point to in the media who, spend their time, their entire careers, keeping eye of what's going on in the corporate world, and not even a large minority seems to be able to voice the same attitude that you're voicing, and I find that really telling of the whole enterprise. And
I appreciate that. I guess I just maybe I have a lower outrage threshold than other people, maybe.
One of the things that I wanted to ask you, at this point, I believe that about 20 people have been charged some of them pleaded guilty to activities when they were at Enron. Now,
right.
And the big, so far the biggest one has been Andy Fastow, and I think a lot of people think that perhaps based on the kind of information that he can provide to the investigators, that it is likely that Ken Lay and Jeff Skilling will be charged. Are there any other people that you think, knowing about the company and the people who ran it, stand out in your mind, maybe people whose names haven't been mentioned all that much, haven't come up in a lot of the coverage, at least not like the big three or four that we've talked about, though, that you think were highly placed in the company and it's likely that we might see some charges against them?
Well, likely, I don't know. The people that should have some of their money taken away, though, I can give you one name right off the top of my head, is Lou Pye.
That's we mentioned him sort of in passing in the last interview, and I wanted to get back to him because I think you said that of all the execs who managed to cash out before the company collapsed, he came away with more money than anybody.
He sold $270 million worth of Enron stock before he quit the company in the summer of 2001. Lou Pye was a PhD mathematician, very smart guy. He, was ethically corrupt. He cheated on his wife. He had a long affair with a stripper that he met in a strip club, later married her, had kids with her. Anyway, the fact is that Pye was a crony of Skilling. Skilling loved Pye because Pye had the math skills that they needed to set up the trading business. Long story short, Pye got all kinds of stock options. He exercised them. He ran Enron Energy Services, which, next to Enron Broadband, was probably the biggest fraudulent scheme that Enron had. And yet, for some reason, the prosecutors can't get anywhere near him. And I think it's partly because Pye, was never on the executive committee. He was never on the board. As far as I know, he hasn't even been named in any civil lawsuits. But he's certainly living the good life now. He owns a 70,000-acre ranch up in Colorado. He's raising horses, and he's living the good life in Houston. So, if there's one person that stands out in my mind as one of the people who was one of the key looters of Enron and yet has escaped any kind of blame or even any scrutiny, it's Lou Pye.
Hmm. Andy Fastow, in addition to agreeing to serve this 10 years in jail, according to the stories that I've read, also agreed to forfeit a fairly significant amount of cash, or at least it seems that way to me, something like about $30 million.
Yeah.
And you think he's got that kind of money, some of these other people have that kind of money. I wonder if an agreement like that is entered into, where that money goes and whether between all of them, if you could round up a significant amount of cash, then would that be used, or could that be used to try to restore some of the losses that employees and stockholders suffered when the company collapsed?
Well, I think that is part of the idea, that some of this restitution money that's being paid will be put into a fund to deal with some of the creditors. The problem is that for a lot of the Enron employees, they are considered unsecured creditors. They are at the back of the line behind the banks, the ones who were held bonds at Enron, and they're going to be tied up in litigation for years with other Enron creditors trying to get a portion of that money. Furthermore, there have been something like 100 civil lawsuits filed in federal and state courts against Enron overall, and the total of all that litigation, the damages sought in all that litigation, is something on the order of $4 billion. Now, only a fraction of that is ever going to be recovered. And so even if Fastow gives up $30 million and, say even Lou Pye gives up all that $200 million, it's only going to be a drop in the bucket compared to all these outstanding claims. And, these people that lost their pensions and their retirement funds, I'm afraid to say it, but, they're just SOL.
When we talked last time, you said that as far as you were concerned, a key issue in all of this was stock option reform.
Yes.
Because the way that a lot of these people in management made a lot of money was in selling stock that had been given to them as part of their compensation packages. And they were in a position to sell that stock, and perhaps because They knew something that other people didn't. They could sell the stock when it was still worth something and not at the point where it crashed and wasn't worth anything. And so some people have said, yeah, that something needs to be done, particularly about that. And for example, that, you know, some law has to be put into place that says, well, if you've got that stock and you're in the management of the company, then you're required to hold it for some period of time. Has indeed, I know some people have been talking about it. I know that Mr. Greenspan has said he thinks that it would be a good idea, and other people have said that they think it would be a good idea. Has there been in Washington actually any movement on this?
Well, there has been some reform and some positive reform, and I mention it in the new afterword in my paperback version of Pipe Dreams, talking about what changes have happened with regard to stock options. I talk about the key issues I think are stock option reform, derivatives reform, and also, you know, enforcement, whether at the SEC and so on, and giving the Securities and Exchange Commission the kind of policing power that it needs. But with regard to stock options, I mean, some of the major reform has happened in corporate America without any regulation coming out of Washington or out of the Federal Accounting Standards Board. So, the Financial Accounting Standards Board. For instance, Microsoft has quit giving stock options. They are now granting stock to employees. the same has happened at a number of other companies. And the Financial Accounting Standards Board, the International Accounting Standards Board, are both looking at new regulations that will require companies to expense their stock options. In other words, to make them account for stock options in a rational way that reflects their true cost to the company. So there is some positive move in that regard to having these companies reflect the true cost of stock options, which is long overdue and is one of the things that really fueled the internet bubble and fueled the abuse of these by these corporate executives like Dennis Kozlowski and Lay and Skilling and Fastow and all these characters.
Well, there we're going to have to leave it. It's very interesting to have you with us. We really appreciate you giving us your time once again.
Thank you very much, David.
Our guest, Robert Bryce. If you'd like to read more on this story, you can look for his book. It's titled Pipe Dreams, Greed, Ego, and the Death of Enron. It's published by Public Affairs, and it is just out now in a paperback edition.